Everybody, please welcome Governor Jerry Brown. Thank you for coming. Welcome.
Well, thank you, and thank you for coming to Sacramento for your confab about journalism and the environment. I think it's a good topic. The two aren't completely congruent, because as journalists, you're interested in news, and the environment is not new by its very nature. It's about the whole system itself, and while change is part of the environment, the understanding of something this complex and this encompassing doesn't fit in our usual categories. We tend to be rather linear thinkers, moving from point A to point B. Something encounters something else, so something occurs as a result. News, as I've heard for many, many years, is not dog bites man, but man bites dog. So it's the unexpected, it's the explosive or the fresh, something that is a little out of the ordinary. So those are some of the rules. And as I try to understand news, I've been trying to understand it for the last 50 years, as a matter of fact. You might not appreciate it, but I'm a student of news. And the very concept of news and the very tight rules that govern what is news and what isn't. Because if it isn't news, you can't write about it. And your editors won't print it. So you have to fit within this, I don't want to call it a metaphysical concept, but I'll call it a construct of news. And it changes in different places, and different papers have slightly different versions. But I'd say that the very idea of news needs to be understood by contrasting with its opposites. And I juxtapose to news ritual. That's another thing I've studied for more than 50 years. I once studied to be a Jesuit priest. We had a great deal of ritual. I won't go into what the rituals were. They too have changed, and that has consequences. But the idea of ritual is very important to understand because it's so different than news. The essence of ritual is invariance. Invariance. So a ritual term that is used by a religious community will be preserved not over decades, but over centuries and even millennia. And the characteristic is of a community giving collective voice in their congregations to these ritual propositions in a certain way. And another key element besides invariance is that it not be verifiable. You don't say at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, we believe that the gross domestic product will grow by 4% next year. You utter propositions that are unverifiable by their nature. And that's why they endure so long. They cannot be exposed. They cannot be deposed. And that's the beauty of ritual, which I rather like, as a matter of fact. Now, news, on the other hand, is all about variance and change and instability. And news, unlike the basic Hebrew prayer, which was discovered being uttered by some Chinese 2,700 years later, maybe one of the lost tribes of Israel or somebody, but they stuck to the utterance. Now, when it comes to the news, well, we got to have it. I always learned that after one news cycle, it's gone. The metaphor I always heard was it's like a ripe fruit in the sun. It's rotten within about 6 hours. So if you're a candidate and you master that art, you know you got to have something new every 6 to 8 hours. And that's what you call re-leading your story. And we did that. I did that a lot when I was Secretary of State. we'd go around and write press releases, and then we'd take one of the paragraphs from lower down in the story, and we'd bring it up and make it the first line. And then, if we couldn't get away with that, we'd send it to another city, and then if we sent it a little later, the guy at AP had already changed, so we could send that out again, and they'd push it through the whole system. Anyway, that's news. And I just want to kind of lay the foundation between news and more constant expressions of humankind. But applying this newsy construct to the problem and the challenges of the environment, particularly climate, a lot of things that are of deep concern are not that exciting. You know, Donald Trump is more important than, no, is more exciting for many journalists than climate change. That's one of your infirmities, too. That's that because you can make a lot of noise, and then that makes for a certain amount of news. The threats and matters that are not right in front of us are very hard to bring forward. So whether it's climate change, which is way off in the future, or a nuclear catastrophe, or a financial meltdown, all the things that are big, because the implications are so serious, many of them are remote. And while they're remote, there's a lot you can do about them. But while they're remote, it's very hard to get anybody interested. And it's also hard to know exactly what to do. So the less information you have, the more ability you have to do something about it. The more you know, oftentimes it's too late. And so I like to think about what things should we be thinking about that right on the front burner. Now, when it comes to climate change, for example, it wasn't very long ago that it was very hard to get anybody to write about climate change. I would give some very interesting statements on climate change. I would stand next to prominent scientists. They would release reports, but it wasn't news. You just couldn't get anybody to write about it. Well, that was a couple of years ago, and now with the Paris Agreement, with a lot of things that are going on, there's a lot more news. And I would say that when I just signed a couple of bills, one on short-lived climate pollutants and one on our new enforceable goals in California for the year 2030, bringing down our greenhouse gases to 40% below 1990, there were a number of newspapers that put that right across the front page. So that was news, not only because climate change has become more salient, but because it was, to some extent, controversial, because oil companies and others were trying to stop it. Now, of course, maybe if the oil companies had embraced it, it wouldn't have been controversial, therefore it wouldn't have been news, therefore you wouldn't have reported about it. So we have to thank people for small favors. So a little bit of controversy goes a long way. Too much undermines what we're trying to do. But when you look at the news and the news about climate change from the professional journals, and you read about the accelerated melting and instability of Antarctica, both the east and the west, more in the west, but they're now even saying the eastern part of Antarctica can melt, not within 1,000 years, but in a much shorter time frame. And then you look at Greenland and what's happening there, and the prediction that used to be 1 foot of climate change by 2100, then it started to be 3 feet, and now very credible scientists are saying 6 feet is more likely by the end of this century, 6 feet. And some would say it could be even more than that. It could be less, because we're dealing with nonlinear phenomena that have tipping points. And those are hard to write about. That's why I started to suggest why the environment is so different. It's everything is related to everything else. It's not objects so much as it is relationships. And when something goes wrong in the ocean or something changes in the atmosphere. And so that, and when one set of predators are stressed, then something happens in their particular niche that has consequences. I mean, try to put all this together, it's very complicated. But people have been trying very hard. the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change put out reports. And then, of course, a lot of people wanted to say, well, they're just doing that to make money. And it's all a fraud. And so there were some email controversies out of England. And there was a great deal of news. And I often, I don't so much anymore, but I used to, on Sunday mornings, go on Google and type in climate change or global warming. And I always found invariably that a third of the stories were debunking climate change. A lot of them came out of Australia, some of them came out of London, some of them came out of America, and other places. So in the effort to report both sides, you have to report the dunkers, the debunkers, as well as the more peer-reviewed and genuine, what I would call genuine scientists. And that becomes a problem, because there are many sides to the story, but that side is not, as Mr. Trump says, it's all a fraud perpetrated by the Chinese to maximize their exports. So, but that gets coverage, and there are many, many millions, if not tens of millions of people who believe that. So the great challenge is how to report facts about climate change, facts about the environment that are interesting, that fit within the construct of news, and help to educate. Because at the rate we're going, we won't achieve the goals that we know scientifically to be necessary. We have to step up the pace. And it's very hard to step up the pace unless there is a strong belief, understanding, and support for what that step up requires. And what the step up requires is a decarbonizing of the economy, which is a shift in agriculture, transportation, manufacturing, tourism, entertainment, residential living, business financing, the whole thing. So there's a lot of change that is required that will demand tremendous understanding and consensus in order for us to get there. World War II, on a day, President Roosevelt said, no more passenger cars. The United States is building tanks and ships. It wasn't very long before Henry Kaiser was putting out a Liberty ship every 30 days. And the tanks were rolling off the assembly plants in Michigan and other places. So that was a real turn. But if you look at where we are, the world's got a billion cars. A fraction of that, less than 1%, are zero polluting, zero emission. And we got to get that up. And we have to get it up at a certain rate of speed. California has goals to achieve that. They're steep, and they will get steeper as we go down the road. So we need the technology, we need the investment, we need the public collaboration, and we also need the understanding. And that's where journalism comes in. Can we communicate through our traditional channels in a way to raise sufficient understanding and consciousness? I would say, right now, the jury is out on that. We don't know. We hope. And that, I think, leads to the next point, that the fact that things are going okay doesn't mean that they are going okay. I'm reading a book that I find very fascinating, entitled Sleepwalking. It's about World War I, how we got into it. I don't know if you saw that. But my big takeaway from Sleepwalking and how we got into World War I is that very smart people, very prominent people, do stupid things. So I'm always asking myself, what prominent people are doing stupid things today? What are the stupid things that we're all doing? Now, at the state, federal, national level. And my hunch is that there are some. And they are pretty, they could be catastrophic. Remember, I think it's good to see, think about World War I for a second. These were smart people. I think a lot of them had studied, had a classical education, studied history, Latin and Greek. Many of them were going to the same church or a very similar church. And some of them were related. They were cousins. And yet, they all marched off with prayers to the Almighty, with bands playing, and with utter enthusiasm. They just marched off, and there it was. And it didn't take very long for the Russian Empire to fall, for the Prussian Empire to, or the Austro-Hungarian Empire to collapse, the Ottoman Empire to collapse, to redraw the Middle East in a way that is still causing tonight untold bloodshed. And that was all done by people who studied Latin and Greek in college. We went to the Anglican and Catholic and Orthodox Church, and they really screwed up. So, are we smarter? Are we more virtuous? Are we more disciplined? Are we more visionary? And it's pretty hard to make that case. So that's why you gotta work harder. You gotta get the word out when you see something stupid. And not the little stupidities, but the big stupidity that sets our society off in a direction that is not sustainable. So environmental reporting is really fundamental. It's so important because many of the things we're doing don't have the public support. They're not about funding a school. They're not about a crime. They're not about, you know, explosive situations that occur in some of our cities. But they will be. They, over time, the shifting of the temperature, the shifting of the seas, the unpredictability of the extreme of the climate has a huge effect. So in California, we are doing some things. It's pretty far-reaching, both in green chemistry, in our goal to regulate short-term climate pollutants like methane and chlorofluorocarbons and black carbon. We're doing that. And as a matter of fact, scientists tell us that if the rest of the world would do what California is proposing to do by 2030, we'd cut the pace of climate change in half. In half. That's how powerful the super pollutants are and how powerful it would be if we can get rid of them. But you can't do it unless there's a sense for it. In California, we're still profiting from the smog of Los Angeles in 1950. Smog was so bad that the politicians of both parties started demanding action. In fact, there was a guy, there's a supervisor in LA County in the 50s. His slogan was SOS, save our state, stamp out smog. Well, by the time Ronald Reagan got to be governor, he signed the Air Resources Act. Richard Nixon signed the Clean Air Act. And by, California had a special prerogative to announce and enforce its own rules on auto emissions. And so we did. And because of that, we've developed the scientists, the regulatory capacity, and the habit of dealing with the poisons that our industrial society generates every day in our atmosphere. So we are charging ahead in that regard, and because when the auto companies collapsed, they had their breakdown, 2008, they were able to be brought to the table, and the California standard was actually adopted as the national standard. And that happened because of the experience, the news that everybody knew in Los Angeles that things were bad. Well, now we've cut we've increased the number of cars 3 or 4 times. We've cut the pollutants by more than 90%. And we can do a lot better. And so can the other states, and so can the other countries. So that's a matter when you can turn a problem into a solution, a lemon into a lemonade. And we need these problems, but we don't want them so catastrophic that we can't really respond. And I would say the news of climate change is coming in. It is based on scientific papers. The events of heat and forest fire and flooding, those are the events of the day. But the real news is the peer-reviewed science that tells us and puts into context the implications of what's happening and what's around the corner. And that really is the challenge, the trick. Can you bring forward the future that doesn't exist and so inspire and educate the citizenry that we take the tough actions, the enlightened actions, to make sure that future that we now see doesn't occur. And so that's the exercise. It's bringing the future forward and then feeling it, experiencing it, and making the difficult and wise decisions now so that that future we can now see doesn't occur, and doesn't certainly occur in the way that we're now predicting it to. So that's the story on climate change from my point of view. California, I would say, is doing far better than most, but our steps are very tentative and very small compared to the magnitude of the problem. And so we have to continue, and it will only get more difficult, and others have to join with us. And the others are not just a few other states, but all the other countries of the world. And that was the exciting consequence of the Paris Accord. And that happened. That was a lot of work, but there's a certain amount of luck there. I mean, if President Xi and President Putin didn't come together and take the lead, it wouldn't have happened. If it didn't happen, we don't know how many years or decades we might not have been set back. So at least we have the thrust, we have the predicate for real news, because there's more of an event and it's more real, and we are at least asking everybody, put up, tell us what you're going to do. So people are watching. Now it's up to journalists to be able to report that and keep us all on our toes. So it's a very exciting time. California is doing what it can. We need to do a lot more, but we can only do what the world of news makes plausible, in some ways makes possible. We are not disembodied political spirits pondering the eternal verities. We are politicians surfing on the surface of your stories. So please, do your best and allow us to keep going. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. We have a couple questions for you.
Okay, Governor Brown, how would you continue to push for climate action on climate change in a Trump or Clinton presidency?
I would push in the same way I'm doing now. And in fact, that answers the question.
Short and sweet. Next question. The federal government just issued suggested guidelines for autonomous cars, and a lot of the companies doing this work are in California. Are you concerned about this new trend, or do you think it's going to be a net positive?
So this is one of these technologies that very smart people, very skilled people, have a better understanding of. But from the range of people who are very excited about this prospect of autonomous vehicles, I would say, and by the fact that the federal government has now come out with their regulations, this is a real potential. And it's a potential that can not only help the economy, can help reduce congestion, but also can reduce pollutants. That as more car, and by the way, these cars can be, in many cases, will be electric cars. If they're driverless, it's done by computers, machines, that will make it cheaper. And if it's cheaper, and you don't have to have an 8-hour day, you can have a 20-hour day. So that means you can run the batteries longer. You can run at a lower cost. You can move people around. And if people find out they can call their autonomous vehicle, and it's a lot cheaper than having a car, and then you get another person or two in it, pretty soon you reduce parking, congestion, pollution, and you actually save money and make the whole society more productive. That is, assuming the proposition is correct, that a robotic driver is better than a human being because it doesn't text, it doesn't drink, it doesn't stare, and it doesn't get distracted. So if this artificial intelligence and this high-powered radar signaling system works, hallelujah. It'll be a great day, and I can assure you California will take the lead and pave the way.
Could we ask you one more question?
Since I didn't really give you the full answer that you wanted in the first question, because I'm still thinking about it.
So California has ambitious greenhouse gas reduction targets and renewable energy goals. What stands in the way of achieving those goals?
Inertia. The journalists not writing properly about the environment. Writing boring stories that nobody reads. Not convincing their editors that they should be on the front page. Stands in the way is this is a shift. You know, there used to be a term, I remember hearing about it a few decades ago, it was very common, paradigm shift. That word used to be thrown around. Well, a paradigm is a pattern. And there's a pattern in how we all live, how we perceive things, and it's it persists because it's strongly embedded in who we are, in our built environment and all the rest. So we're talking about changing that. And that's expensive, that takes creativity, that takes a great deal of political will. And what we're talking about is imagining a future, bringing it forward, and preferring it to today. You know, to today's news, today's pleasure, today's excitement, the now. So we have to take care of business, and we have our daily tasks. But we also have to have the vision of how do we sustain what we're doing. And we know that life is change. But we all get caught in a certain stasis or way of doing things. And we do have a way of doing things. You know, in California, we require our 32 million vehicles to go 335 billion miles every year and consume 18 billion gallons of gasoline and diesel. Now, to say, okay, gang, let's cut that in half, or at least part of it, get new fuels, different kind of cars, maybe you live closer to where you work, that is a transformation. And the transformation, it takes time, but it takes some shock to the system. Some people can't stop smoking unless they get a heart attack. Then they get the willpower. Well, we need enough of a shock that wakes us up, but doesn't knock us out. So that's what you have to deliver. You have to deliver that sense. Or at least somebody's got to deliver it, and you got to report it. I guess that's the proper way to balance what you do and what I do. So it's going to take a change on every level. Schools, manufacturers, political personalities, entertainment, international relations. This is something that is so global and so just everything is a part of this big whole, which is the ecology, the environment, the atmosphere above and the soil and the ocean below. That's what it is. And so we've got to deal with it. And it's very hard to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But something like that is what's required.
Governor Brown, thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you so much.